LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hello and welcome to LRIS's First Thursday podcast. My name is Will Acheson and I'll be taking you through a review of last month's developments in public safety labor relations issues. And the place that we have to start is with Detroit. Detroit's been in the news a great deal lately. In mid-March, the governor of Michigan appointed an emergency manager, a lawyer by the name of Kevin Orr, from a Washington, D.C. law firm. The emergency manager will be operating under a very controversial Michigan law that allows the manager essentially the right to take over the entire city government, to make decisions and implement them without the approval of the mayor or the city council, to renegotiate labor contracts, to basically tear up labor contracts. Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, is a veteran of the restructuring of Chrysler and refers to the restructuring of Detroit as the Olympics of restructuring. What is Mr. Orr facing? He's facing a cash shortage, a shortfall of about $14 billion in long-term liabilities, and he's got to find some way to make that up. Already, there have been challenges and protests about the appointment of the emergency manager. A lot of fingers are pointing at the political issues inherent in the appointment of the manager. The Republican governor appointed the manager over the objections of the Democratic City Council in Detroit. Others are pointing at the emergency manager's salary. He's going to be paid $275,000, which to some seems anomalous given Detroit's very difficult financial situation. And already there has been a lawsuit filed. It was filed on March 27th, challenging the very law under which the emergency manager was appointed. It's called Public Act 436. This is a lawsuit filed by a lot of groups. It's been supported by some at a national level, including Reverend Al Sharpton of the National Action Network. The heart of the challenge is that the emergency manager law creates an entirely new and impermissible system of government in Michigan. That really the only forms of governments that are allowed are cities and counties with traditional elected bodies running them, and that this new form of government takes away, disenfranchises the ability of people to choose their own governmental representatives. It's early yet. This is going to unfold over the next few months. But Detroit is clearly the largest city that has ever been under an emergency manager. And it is also very clear from Mr. Orr's early statements that he intends to engage in some serious cutting in Detroit government. There's another development in Michigan that has been in the news. And this involves the city of Ypsilanti, Michigan. And what Ypsilanti is contemplating doing, in fact, it has gone long down the road of doing it, is combining its police and fire departments into a public safety agency. The reason, once again, money, an attempt to consolidate costs. We've seen consolidated police and fire agencies around the country for many years. Not many. The city of Sunnyvale in California is an example. City of Kalamazoo in Michigan is another example. Both of them have been around for some time. There are some slightly consolidated public safety agencies in Florida, and a number of financially strapped cities are looking at consolidation of police and fire into a public safety agency right now. So far, Ypsilanti hasn't actually implemented it, but it is projecting cost savings in the millions of dollars, basically through the elimination of mid-level management positions. The city manager is actually projecting that it will be able to hire more public safety officers than the combination of police and firefighters. Also in the news has been the New Orleans Police Department. New Orleans has been prominent in terms of developments over the course of the last year. The police department is under a very controversial consent decree. There have been challenges made to the United States Department of Justice and as to the integrity of the Department of Justice prosecutors who were working on the consent decree. But that's actually relatively old news. What's new is that there's been a lot of talk recently about staffing in the New Orleans Police Department. Staffing has reached an all-time low in the department. And there has been an investigation that was performed by a local TV station that revealed that the average response time for emergency calls that indicate a violent crime is being committed, the average response time is 14 and a half minutes. That is just an amazing response time compared to those in other large cities. There have been news reports after that study was released showing that in some cases it takes longer than an hour to respond to calls of a beating. Also in the news with respect to New Orleans in the last week or so has been that the equivalent of the city council in New Orleans has decided to impose a residency requirement. It will apply only to new officers, and new employees who are hired will have a period of 180 days to live or to move inside the city limits. Now let's see if we can add those two stories together and see what we get. Staffing is at an all-time low in the New Orleans Police Department. It takes 14 and a half minutes to respond to felony calls, and the city council wants to impose a residency requirement for new police officers. Can't imagine what could go wrong in those circumstances. The last story that's been in the news that I think is worth talking about a little bit is that the Chicago police negotiations have ratcheted up even one more notch. You have a new mayor in Chicago, the former chief of staff for President Obama, Rahm Emanuel, is the new mayor. And he has collided with the Fraternal Order of Police that represents the city's rank-and-file police officers. There have been very difficult public statements made on each side. Negotiations are ongoing, but the parties are very, very far apart in the negotiations. This has all been exacerbated by the fact that the city is contending that the FOP failed to open the contract on a timely basis. The FOP is pushing back and saying, no, we did open the contract on a timely basis. And then, over the course of the last couple of months, the city announced that it had negotiated a deal with its sergeants union. And the deal with the sergeants union would have been a settlement that was much less generous to Chicago police sergeants than the FOP's proposal in the rank and file negotiations. It would have involved concessions in the area of pensions, wage increases that were much lower, and the like. The FOP sent a letter to the sergeants, the rank and file sergeants, urging them to vote against the contract. And in fact, by a 7-to-1 ratio, the sergeants rejected the deal. It's back to the negotiating table for the city with the sergeants. That tentative agreement has now fallen apart. And so it looks like we have a very, very long road in front of us in the Chicago police negotiations. No public word yet as to what's going on with the city and its firefighters. Let's now turn to the case law. There have been, in particular, a couple of very, very significant cases decided over the course of the last month, cases that I think are going to have legs that are are going to be with us for some time in terms of their impact. The first comes out of the Boston Police Department, and it involves drug testing. And to understand what's going on in this case, you have to understand that disciplinary appeals in the Boston Police Department actually go through a body known as the Massachusetts Civil Service Commission. Boston has had a fairly recent history of drug testing. There have been lots of legal challenges over the drug testing in Boston. Federal courts ruled that the city's random drug testing policy did not violate the federal constitution, but the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled that random testing violated the state constitution. And notwithstanding those collective or seemingly colliding rulings, the city has been conducting drug testing for some time. Boston is one of the few cities that uses hair tests in lieu of urine or blood tests for drugs. New York City is another one that uses hair tests. And the decision of the Civil Service Commission in this case that is so significant deals with whether or not hair tests are of a sufficient degree of reliability upon which to base a disciplinary decision. This is a case that involved 10 police officers. All of them were subject to random testing. All of them tested positive with the hair test for cocaine, and all 10 of them were fired. In 6 of the 10 cases, the hair tests were essentially the only factual grounds for the officer's termination. In the remaining 4 cases, there were some other indicia of drug use. The cases ended up, these cases had hung around for some time, and they ended up being consolidated. And the Civil Service Commission issued a lengthy decision, 134 pages long. You can download it from our webpage, and ended up concluding that hair testing was not sufficiently reliable upon which to base a disciplinary decisions. Here's what the essence of the commission's ruling is, and I'm going to read a couple of sentences here from the commission's decision. The commission said of the laboratories that offer hair testing to employers, testing methods vary from laboratory to laboratory. And while some parameters, such as cutoffs and decontamination procedures, are generally described in published literature, substantial parts of the methodologies are hidden. Why are they hidden? The commission says they're hidden because they're considered to be proprietary by the laboratories that use these or conduct these hair tests. And the commission ends up concluding that there's just not enough indicia of scientific reliability to hair tests to base a termination decision upon. Once again, back to the commission's decision. And the commission holds that although a lack of unanimity of opinion doesn't necessarily preclude a finding of general acceptance of the reliability of hair tests, especially as to a new scientific method, the criticism of hair tests from sources such as the FBI laboratory represents more than merely one side of a legitimate scientific debate. In particular, the scientific evidence is compelling that no proven level of any cocaine metabolite has been identified that is conclusive of ingestion. So the commission ends up throwing out the hair tests for these 10 officers. What does it do then? Because it does have still the disciplinary decisions to deal with. Well, remember, 6 of the officers had been terminated solely on the basis of the hair tests. The commission reverses their terminations and orders them reinstated. The other 4 officers, the ones who did have other indicators of drug use, the commission upheld the termination decision, but on evidence that was independent from the hair tests. The next case that I think is going to be significant is a firefighter case that comes to us out of the city of St. Petersburg, Florida. And it's a little bit complicated factually, but not too much so. This is a case that involves a fellow by the name of Bradley Westfall. And Westfall is a paramedic, firefighter paramedic, who injured his back and knee in the course of his employment. His injuries were pretty severe, resulted in nerve damage in his legs, required surgery, spinal surgery, and other medical treatment. And he had a very lengthy recovery period. Under Florida law, the workers' compensation statutes cap what's called temporary total disability benefits at 104 weeks. So in other words, if you're off work with a compensable injury, and no one doubted that Westfall had a compensable injury, your benefits run out after 104 weeks. If you become medically stationary, in other words, your condition's not going to get any better or any worse, then your case can be closed out. And if you have a disability, you may be entitled to permanent disability benefits. But if you're not medically stationary, as Westfall wasn't, because Westfall was getting better, you end up in a no man's land, because your temporary disability benefits will run out after 104 weeks, and you're not entitled to permanent disability benefits because your condition is not medically stationary. Westfall challenged this, and challenged it on constitutional grounds under the Florida Constitution. Florida, like Massachusetts that we've just talked about, has a state constitution that is considered by the state Supreme Court to grant more rights to Florida citizens than does the federal constitution to citizens of the United States. There's various ways in which from time to time you see these decisions from the Florida Supreme Court popping up saying, we know the federal courts are interpreting the law one way, but our constitution is more generous in this way to Florida citizens. For example, the right to privacy under Florida law is thought to be more robust than the right to privacy under the federal constitution. And the Florida Supreme Court, the Florida Court of Appeals in Westfall's case, taking a look at the Florida Constitution, says the cap of 104 weeks is unconstitutional. And the words of the court are very sweeping. And here's what the court has to say. This result, this no man's land result, where you're not eligible either for temporary disability payments or permanent disability payments, this result, and I'm quoting, cannot comport with any legal or natural notion of justice. It violates Westfall's state constitutional right of access to courts, and it violates his right to the administration of justice without denial or delay under the Florida Constitution. The result is repugnant to fundamental fairness because it relegates a severely injured worker to a legal twilight zone of economic and familial ruin. So what does the court do with the case? It's now struck down the limit of 104 weeks as the cap on temporary disability payments. What the court said is, well, we have to take a look at what the law was before the cap was imposed. And what the law was before the cap was imposed was a 260-week limitation. So the law will revert under a doctrine that's known as judicial revival to the 260-week cap on temporary total disability status, meaning that Westfall would continue to be eligible for his benefits. This case is significant, I think, for a bunch of reasons. But to understand the significance, we kind of have to take a step back and look at what's really going on with the workers' compensation system. Workers' compensation systems like Florida's were enacted in the early 1900s, largely, and they involve a trade-off. And the trade-off is the employee gives up their right to sue the employer for negligence, where the employer's negligence causes injuries to the employee on the job. In exchange for that, the employee gets the benefits of a workers' compensation system, a workers' compensation system that has benefits that are payable without regard to negligence. You don't need employer negligence to recover workers' compensation benefits, but has benefit levels that are very commonly much lower than those that you could get through the court system. So it's a trade-off. Employees gain the right to benefits even if the employer is not negligent, but on the other hand, employees give up the right to sue and potentially recover higher levels of damages. And that trade-off has been upheld all around the country. And what the Florida Court of Appeals is saying in this case is look, if you end up constricting workers' compensation benefits so much, in this case, if you create this legal twilight zone where an injured worker who's recovering is cut off from any benefits, you have disturbed that balance. You have disturbed that trade-off to the point where you are unconstitutionally depriving the employee of their right to justice. Now, that is an opinion that, even though it's decided under the Florida Constitution, may well have legs, particularly if you are in a state that, like Florida, likes to construe its own constitution as having greater benefits, greater protections than the federal constitution. Let's bounce now from the courts over to arbitrators. And there's a fascinating case that has come out of Ohio, one, frankly, that I question whether it's at least correctly reasoned. I don't know about whether the result is the correct one, but it's a fascinating one, and it's a Facebook case. Let's call this our Facebook case of the month. Unfortunately, we have enough examples of Facebook cases that we could do a Facebook case of the month, or for that matter, a Facebook case of the week if we wanted to. This one involved Jesse Hubbard, who's a corrections officer, 15 years on the job, no disciplinary record. And he worked for the state correctional system in Ohio, worked at the Lebanon, Ohio Correctional Institution. Hubbard made a post to Facebook, and he made the post after what was referred to as Senate Bill 5 in Ohio. Senate Bill 5 was this attempt by Governor John Kasich, who then had just been elected in 2011, his attempt to severely cut back on the collective bargaining rights of public employees in Ohio. Senate Bill 5 passed the legislature and was repealed by the voters through a referendum process. Well, while that was all going on, that whole process was going on, Hubbard posted something on Facebook that said, and I'm quoting, "Okay, we got Bin Laden. Let's go get Kasich next. Who's with me?" A grand total of 17 people viewed the post and indicated that they liked the comment. Four of these people who liked the comment worked at the Lebanon Correctional Institution with Hubbard. An anonymous complaint was made to Governor Kasich's office. An investigation was started. And the state fired Hubbard for conduct unbecoming. Hubbard's labor organization, AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, challenged his discharge in arbitration. The arbitrator overturned the discharge, but reinstated Hubbard without back pay. It was the equivalent of a 14-month suspension. And the arbitrator disagreed with the state that Hubbard's post could be viewed as a threat. In fact, he described Hubbard's comments as nothing more than empty words. But the arbitrator found that Hubbard was at fault. Why? The arbitrator said Hubbard disparaged the governor, and the arbitrator doesn't view this as a mere joke. It was uttered in a public forum, Facebook, and exhibited a certain job-related nexus. His Facebook profile designated his job location and his public employee status, and these conditions amount to conduct unbecoming a corrections officer. And so, as a result, the arbitrator does decide that Hubbard is subject to discipline, and he ends up with a 14-month suspension for that Facebook post. Why do I quibble with this arbitrator's logic? It's because of what the arbitrator doesn't do. He doesn't examine the free speech implications of what Hubbard had to say. And there's a case from the United States Supreme Court that really, I think, demanded that the arbitrator analyze. I'm not going to say how I think the arbitrator should have come out on this issue, but I can tell you he should have looked at it. And the case is called Rankin versus McPherson. It's an oldie but goodie. It's a 1987 case. And Rankin involved a deputy constable, that's a type of police officer, deputy constable who was listening to a radio account of the attempted assassination on President Reagan. And she commented to a fellow worker, "Shoot, if they go for him again, I hope they get him." The deputy constable was fired. And the United States Supreme Court found that speech to be protected by the First Amendment. The notion being, of course, that this is a comment about a public figure, about the President of the United States, and that there was no threat in the statement. It was just simply a form of political speech, rugged political speech, but the Supreme Court has held many times that even rugged political speech is subject to constitutional protection. I think the arbitrator in the Ohio case should have looked at that line of cases, disparaging the governor of Ohio. Isn't that indeed amounts to a comment about the performance of a public figure? And it's hard to see the distinction between saying, on one hand, shoot, if they go for him again, I hope they get him, the President Reagan comments, and Hubbard's comments, okay, we got bin Laden, let's go get Kasich next. Who's with me? It at least demanded analysis. While we're talking about arbitrators, let's talk about the public policy issue again. This is something that I spoke about in last month's podcast, and it's the question of when an arbitrator's opinion violates public policy. Last month's podcast, I dealt with a decision out of the Connecticut Court of Appeals, and in that case, you had a police officer who was admittedly untruthful, and an arbitrator found that the officer was untruthful, but nonetheless found enough mitigating circumstances to warrant reinstating the officer with a disciplinary suspension. The Connecticut Court of Appeals overturned the arbitrator's opinion and found that the opinion violated public policy because there was a public policy against untruthfulness on the part of police officers. In the podcast last month, I mentioned that the court really took a different approach than most courts looking at the public policy doctrine. That most courts looking at the public policy doctrine don't look at whether or not the employee's conduct violates public policy, but rather look at whether the arbitrator's decision ordering reinstatement violates public policy. In other words, is there some public policy out there that says that the only disciplinary sanction that can be imposed for a particular type of offense, in the Connecticut case on truthfulness, is termination, and that any other type of disciplinary sanction violates public policy? It's a different analysis, and the Connecticut court that I talked about last month really was marching to the beat of a different drummer than most courts in the country. This month's case, which comes out of Massachusetts, is a case that does not follow the Connecticut approach and does follow the dominant approach in the country. And this is a case that comes out of the Massachusetts Court of Appeals. It's an off-duty police officer. He works for the city of Worcester, Massachusetts. His name is David Ralston. Ralston is on injury leave, and he ends up getting into a fracas with a group of teenagers in his yard. A neighbor had warned him that teenagers were lurking about his yard and potentially looking into houses and the like. Ralston arms himself with his department-issued handgun and a flashlight, confronts the teenagers, and in the process orders them down to the ground, inadvertently hits one of the teenagers in the back of the head with his gun, and also may have kicked, presumably inadvertently as well, another of the teenagers. The city then fires Ralston after conducting an investigation and concludes that he violated the constitutional rights of the teenagers. And Ralston's labor organization challenges the termination in arbitration. He was represented by the New England PBA. And the arbitrator ends up reinstating Ralston. The arbitrator concludes that, Ralston's version of the events was true. He didn't precipitate the events of the confrontation, but rather responded to the provocative movements of the three teenagers. And the way the arbitrator phrased it was that Ralston, by virtue of the circumstances, and this is a quote, was denied the full spectrum of equipment and image that is inherent in the expectation of a continuum of force. I'm satisfied that he applied his scant resources in a reasonable manner, given the fact he was outnumbered and had no reason to believe that these persons had engaged in merely a trespass. The city then challenges the arbitrator's opinion in court and argues that it violates public policy. And the city's argument is that Ralston violated the constitutional rights of these teenagers. And the court, following that traditional analysis that I mentioned earlier, says, nope, city, you're asking the wrong question. The court says the question to be answered is not whether the officer's conduct itself violates public policy, but whether the award to reinstate him does so. If an award is permissible, even if not optimal for the furtherance of public policy goals, it must be upheld. And the court ends up concluding that there's no public policy that required that Ralston be fired. Hence, the arbitrator's opinion should be upheld. The next case that's an interesting one comes out of a non-union environment. And occasionally I'll find that public safety administrators and employees and those involved in public safety union movement tend to think that the same job protections apply to all public safety employees around the country. For example, the fact that you've got a rigorous arbitration system for firefighters in California, that means that that's the way that a firefighter is going to be treated in Virginia. And in fact, in those states without labor contracts, you end up finding decisions that might come out differently in arbitration. And that's the case with a Kentucky Court of Appeals decision that came down in the middle of March or late March of 2013. It's one of these cases that has difficult facts and, you know, the old adage that bad facts make bad law. That may be the case here. This is a case involving Gary Murphy. And Murphy was a police officer with the city of Richmond, Kentucky. And the case actually starts with somebody else. It starts with a sergeant by the name of James Rogers, who responds to a domestic violence call at the home of one April McQueen. Rogers and McQueen end up developing a relationship out of the call. And during the course of the relationship, which turns sexual, McQueen tells Rogers that she enjoys, in her words, rough sex. And she enjoys, again, her words, being dominated and having sex with multiple partners. Rogers decides he's going to oblige, and he invites Murphy and another officer from the department to go to McQueen's home to have group sex. During the course of the night, McQueen suffers a split lip and bruises on her neck and other parts of her body. The officers all leave. McQueen goes to a neighbor's house to get ice for her split lip. The neighbor ends up reporting the situation to the local sheriff's office, and an investigation starts. It's both a criminal investigation and it's a disciplinary investigation. The three officers are eventually indicted on a number of criminal charges, and the administrative investigation is put on hold. However, the case goes to trial, and the officers are all acquitted on a not guilty jury verdict. McQueen is saying, this is completely consensual, and I do not have any difficulties with what happened that night. The department then fires the officers, and Murphy appeals. It's unclear whether Rogers appeals or whether the other officer appeals. The legal issues in the case that the Kentucky Court of Appeals ends up deciding, the legal issues deal with Murphy's appeals. And Murphy's basic argument is, look, this is conduct that is consensual, it is private, and you, a police department, don't have the right to disapprove of that conduct through the imposition of discipline, much less termination. The way Murphy phrased it was that the group sex did not have any prohibited effect on the police department or the employees. Rather, Murphy says, it's the publicity regarding the conduct that had the prohibited effect. Well, the Kentucky Court of Appeals kind of sort of agrees with Murphy. It says, behavior that is completely private, that's known only to the participants, can't be the basis for a conduct unbecoming charge. And we wouldn't uphold discipline in that sort of case. The problem, the court says, is that Murphy's behavior doesn't fall in that category. The court says Murphy's behavior, no matter what his intent was or the intent of the other participants, became public. The point of the conduct unbecoming regulation, the court says, is to ensure that if an officer's behavior becomes public and has an adverse impact on fellow officers or the department, it can be the basis of discipline. And here's the court's bottom line on the case. And I'm quoting, Murphy chose to engage in conduct which was likely to be viewed as aberrant by the community at large with three other people. When he did so, he took the risk that his conduct would become public. He cannot now escape responsibility for his choice by claiming he did nothing to publicize that conduct. And the court upholds his termination. So back to the point that I originally made. Those of you listening to this podcast who are in a state where you have a rigorous civil service system or a public safety commission system, or where you have binding arbitration of discipline, same result, do you think? Private sexual conduct becomes public only because a neighbor complains of it and is largely publicized by virtue of the investigation itself? Maybe, but I'm not so sure. You find now arbitrators and civil service commissions imposing a very strong burden of proof in these sorts of cases, off-duty sex cases, a rigorous burden of proof on employers to show that actual harm has resulted to the employer from the employee's conduct. Perhaps that existed in Murphy's case. The record that you see in the court doesn't suggest it. But what's written in the court's opinion makes you wonder whether this case comes out the same way in an arbitration situation. But for Murphy, it really doesn't matter. He didn't have binding arbitration, he didn't have a labor organization, and he doesn't have his job anymore. Next up is a sexual harassment case. This case, I don't think, really is news in the sense that there's any developments that are different from what we've seen for many years. I highlight it for this podcast to illustrate the state of the law and the state of the law that frequently is not quite well understood, the law about sexual harassment, and in particular, whether or not sexual comments, even repeated sexual comments, can be the basis for a hostile work environment sexual harassment claim. This is a case that comes out of another state correctional facility, this one in Indiana. And the plaintiff in the case, the person doing the suing, is Nora Chibe. She's a correctional officer, new hire, and she participated in a six-week course of classroom instruction and then had a six-month probationary period. And among her various trainers was a field training officer by the name of Leonard Van Dyne. Almost immediately, Van Dyne began to make sexually offensive comments to Chibe. On one occasion, Van Dyne made the remark that he and his wife liked to have threesomes and inquired if Chibe liked threesomes as well. Chibe responded, kind of stuck up for herself, and said that she didn't like the way he talked to her. And shortly thereafter, Van Dyne did the right thing. He removed himself as her training officer. However, the two still had contact on the job, and just would run into each other, and Van Dyne would continue to make sexual comments to Chibe. In a second encounter, Van Dyne asked her, and I'm quoting here, "Do your nipples get hard yet?" when she was working outside in the cold weather during her shift. In another incident, Van Dyne asked her, "Do you bend over when you pick something up, or do you squat? Do you squat?" And Van Dyne was frequently negative about Chibe's work performance. He swore at her repeatedly, made comments like, "Do your fucking job," and things like that. And the two ended up really at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of whether they were getting along. Chibe didn't report Van Dyne's harassing conduct to her supervisor. Instead, she waited and eventually put a memo through channels. There was a investigation that was conducted into Van Dyne, and Van Dyne ended up being reprimanded. After a series of disciplinary incidents, Chibe eventually resigned from her job, and then she sued the state, claiming, among other things, sexual harassment. And the court rejects Chibe's harassment claims and starts out by listing, and this is where I think the point of emphasis is really important as to how far the law has come in this area. It starts by listing the four essential elements of a sexual harassment claim. And says that, look, what Chibe has to show is that she's subjected to unwelcome harassment, that the harassment was based on her sex, that the conduct was sufficiently severe or pervasive so as to alter a condition of employment and create a hostile atmosphere, and that there was a basis for employer liability. The court says we don't need to go any further than number three, whether or not the conduct was sufficiently severe or pervasive to alter a condition of Chibe's employment. And the court says just this, these types of comments don't amount to that. The court says that, look, while Chibe has presented sufficient evidence to demonstrate that she received unwelcome harassment based on her sex, it wasn't either severe enough or lengthy enough to be the basis for a lawsuit under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And the way the court puts it in its opinion is, viewing the record in the light most favorable to Chibe, Van Dyne made three inappropriate comments to Chibe that were sexual in nature. The court referred to those comments as isolated and stress the fact that Van Dyne never physically touched or threatened Chibe in any way. And the court ends up concluding that Chibe didn't establish the basic elements of sexual harassment. And in fact, even if she had, She couldn't show that the state responded inappropriately by reprimanding Van Dyne. The way the court put it is that the state's reprimand of Van Dyne satisfied its duty, the immediate investigation and the decision to reprimand him. There's a few points here that I think are worth stressing about the sexual harassment cases. The first is, it's a rare day when we see a successful sexual harassment case reported involving public safety officers. There's been a series of decisions from the United States Supreme Court in the last 10, 12 years that have significantly cut back on the definition of what is sexual harassment. What might have been viewed as the basis for a sexual harassment complaint 20 years ago just isn't today, just doesn't amount to it. And if I had to guess, and I am totally making this number up, I would guess that far less than 5% of sexual harassment claims by public safety employees actually result in any sort of victory for the employee, much less any sort of damages for the employee. These cases are just very, very difficult to bring. And the second thing is that the courts have really tightened up on the definition of what amounts to sexual harassment, particularly in this area of sexually harassing comments. This is thanks to a particular Supreme Court case, one involving Clark County, Nevada, where the court made it pretty clear that sexually suggestive comments would have to be pretty terrible, pretty long-standing, and actually have a material impact on the employee's job status in order to amount to something that was actionable under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And the third point I think this case illustrates is that you'll see employees claiming in these sexual harassment cases or racial harassment cases that, look, it's true the employer investigated this, but we don't like what the employer did to the harasser. In the case of Chibe, we don't like the fact that the employer merely reprimanded the harasser. The courts are pretty resolute in saying, look, so long as the employer takes some sort of disciplinary action upon a proven finding of sexual harassment or racial harassment, and maybe it doesn't even need to amount to disciplinary action. It might involve simply transferring the harasser. So long as the employer does something, we're not in the business of second-guessing precisely what it is the employer does. And the employer will have, in our judgment, have taken significantly enough remedial action that it can insulate itself from liability under Title VII. So three themes of harassment case law that this Chibe case illustrates. The last case I want to talk about is a first-time case. Haven't seen one of these before, and it involves a police officer, or in this case a corrections officer, who is suing the employer because the employer required or strongly suggested that the employee be tased with a taser as part of training, and injuries resulted to the officer from the tasing. This is a Montana corrections officer, a fellow named David Harris. He's a member of the special response team at the Montana State Prison. Membership on the team is voluntary, and if officers are selected to join the team, they have to go through some pretty rigorous training requirements. They receive an additional 50 cents an hour for their work for being a team member. In 2006, the warden at the prison decided that the prison would purchase a number of tasers manufactured by Taser International. And in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendations, the warden issued a policy requiring all individuals who wanted to use a taser to undergo taser training, which included a 5-second taser exposure. Harris underwent the training and was exposed to the taser for the 5 seconds, and later claimed to have sustained injuries to his thoracic and lumbar spine. He did receive workers' compensation benefits, so the workers' compensation system accepted the fact that the taser had resulted in his injuries, but he also sued the state. Well, how can you sue the state if you're getting workers' compensation benefits? And the way you can in many states is that if the employer has intentionally harmed you, and the standards for that vary from state to state, but if the employer has intentionally harmed you, you can sue the employer. Maybe not in addition to receiving workers' compensation benefits the way Harris wanted to, but you do have a right to sue the employer. And this case goes all the way up to the Montana Supreme Court, which has to decide whether or not Harris made a sufficient allegation that the state intentionally harmed him. The court said, look, we're going to have a two-part test to decide whether or not the employee is intentionally harmed. Part one, did the employer engage in an intentional and deliberate act that was actually intended to cause injury? And secondly, did the employer have knowledge of the injury's certainty? And the court ends up saying, look, we don't have either of those standards met here. And turning to the court's opinion, the court said, look, all there was here was a chance of injury, at best, a chance of injury from the taser exposure. And that is not the same as an employer's deliberate act to injure an employee. Quoting from the court's decision, Harris's supervisors made the potential risks of the tasing very clear to Harris. They provided mats and spotters to protect him. His supervisors underwent the 5-second exposure before Harris. He wasn't asked to do anything the supervisors weren't willing to do. The policy, the court says, was not meant to injure the trainees. Instead, the policy was meant to ensure that employees who wanted to use the taser learned how to do so in a safe manner. There's nothing to suggest, the court said, that state officials deliberately acted with the intent to harm Harris. And even though the standards on what intentional conduct might be that would constitute an exception to the workers' compensation laws, even though those standards vary from state to state, I think this case likely comes out exactly the same way no matter where you are. Might there be a claim against Taser International? A negligence claim against Taser for failing to warn of the potential for injuries? Well, that's a different story. That might not be barred by workers' compensation laws. That claim would have to stand on its own merits, one way or the other. But Harris didn't sue Taser. He sued the state, and he ended up finding that his case was barred by the workers' compensation laws. Let's turn now to recent settlements or arbitrated decisions in contracts and look around the country at what's going on. There are several, I think, pretty notable cases. Most of them are police cases this time rather than fire cases. Several, or I say cases, settlements. Several fairly notable ones that are out there. And let's start with the Bakersfield, California Police Department. This one's mostly notable because it finally got done. This is the first contract, or as they're called in California, Memoranda of Understanding, first contract between the city and the police association since 2007. What ends up being the case with the contract? There will be two raises under the contract. None will be, one will be retroactive. Both of them will be retroactive, but not very retroactive. The first raise is retroactive to December of 2011. It's 3%. And then there'll be another 3% raise effective July of 2012. So in other words, a 6% raise over covering a 6-year period of time, actually a 7-year period of time because this contract expires on June 30, 2013. There are cutbacks in the area of health insurance, and there also have been changes in the pension system in Bakersfield. So all in all, this is a contract where the 6% raise is not going to, over this time period, not only not going to match up against what the consumer price index has been, it'll be far less than that. But when you take into account the reductions in total compensation, this is a settlement that produces a net decrease for the police officers, pretty significant one. By my count, when you include the cost of living at a double-digit net decrease in total compensation over this period of time. The next contract is a big one. It comes from the Hartford, Connecticut Police Department. This, too, is one that's been hanging around for a while. The last contract expired on June 30 of 2010. But this one calls for more in the way of raises. The first raise will only be retroactive to July 1, 2012. And for the period, for that period July 1, 2012 through January 1 of 14, there will be 1.75% every 6 months. So, in other words, we're going to end up with a July 1, 2012 retro, 1.75%, and then January 1, 2013, 1.75, July 1, 2013, 1.75, and January 1 of 2014, 1.75. Two more years on the contract, 2014-2015. The 2014 raise will be 3.5%. 2015 raise will be 3%. The contract has some changes to fringe benefits as well. Comp time max will be increased from 160 hours to 200 hours. There are going to be some changes in the internal investigation process that specify that witnesses in IA investigations will be entitled to union representation. And also there's going to be some cutbacks in the area of post-retirement health insurance. The other raises that we see out there in contracts among big city police departments, a little bit higher than we've seen in the last few months. We see a number of examples of raises in the 3% range. So Lincoln, Nebraska Fire Department, 2012, 3% raise, 2013, 3.25% raise with a new longevity benefit. The New Haven, Connecticut Police Department, 2012 raise, 3%. No raise in 2014 or in 2013, but in 2014 and 2015, two more 3% raises. Albany, New York Police Department. This is a supervisory unit, and this is an arbitrated case, and 1.5% raises every 6 months. So the equivalent of 3% raises. There are some that are below that. Sioux City, Iowa, for example, a raise in 2013 of 1.75%, and then in 14 and 15, raises of 2 and 2.25%. But for the first time in a long, long time, we're starting to see fair amount of contracts poking up there in the 3% range. How are the CPI numbers coming in? The most recent CPI numbers show an essentially unchanged consumer price index. The CPIW, the Wage Earners and Clerical Workers Index, which is the index that most labor contracts are tied to, if they are tied to a CPI at all. The national figures on that, rising at a rate of 1.9%. Medical increases continue to be moderate, a 3.3% annual rate of increase in medical costs over the course of the last 12 months. The regional costs of living, not too much different from that national figure of 1.9%. It's a little bit lower in the South, 1.8%, a little bit higher in the Midwest, at 2.2%, but overall we're looking at a CPI roughly in the range of 2%. That's it for this month. Join us again next month for First Thursday from Labor Relations Information System. Thanks.